couple of years now, and it's actually still in progress, but I think all of what I describe has already appeared on the archive by now. So this is work with Davide Gaiotto and Greg Moore, which appeared on HepTH within the last couple of years. And what I'm going to describe is a connection between two sort of a priori unrelated subjects. So the first of which is the theory of Donaldson-Thomas invariants, or I guess they should be more properly called generalized Donaldson-Thomas invariants, not motivic. I won't be talking about motivic Donaldson-Thomas invariants in this talk. But these are the same kind of objects. These are sort of the Euler character version of the objects that appeared in Jim's talk yesterday, although I'll have sort of the mirror perspective on them. So that's the first object. And the second thing that I'll describe is hyperkähler geometry of complex integrable systems. So the main point of the talk is that there's a link between these two things, that roughly speaking, every time you have a situation, a kind of Donaldson-Thomas situation, where you have a family of Donaldson-Thomas invariants with the correct sort of wall crossing properties, that there's a corresponding complex integrable system lurking. That complex integrable system actually has a hyperkähler metric, and you can even construct that hyperkähler metric from the Donaldson-Thomas invariants. So that's the goal. That's what's to be explained. So let me start with number one here. And in fact, let me give a sort of loose motivation. Loose motivation regarding number one. So I want to describe the mirror picture to what Jim described. So let's take a Calabi-Yau threefold X. And by a Calabi-Yau threefold, I really mean a Ricci flat Kähler manifold, a complex dimension three. So it has a holomorphic volume form, which I'll call H. Usually determined only up to complex rescaling, but let's fix the norm by requiring that H wedge H bar is actually equal to the volume form on the Calabi-Yau. And then let's talk about classes in the middle homology. So let's let gamma be the lattice, of the integral third homology, then define for every gamma in this lattice, let's define z gamma to be just the period of this holomorphic three-form over gamma. So now suppose we have some actual three-cycle, not just a class, but an actual three-cycle. For a three-cycle L in the class gamma, there's an inequality that says that the volume of that three-cycle, measured in the Ricci-Fled metric, is always at least equal to, the period of this holomorphic volume form in absolute value. So I just write the volume is greater than or equal to the absolute value of Z. And then we're particularly interested in the minimizers, the ones that saturate this inequality. So if this inequality is saturated, then we call L special Lagrangian. And so one of the things you can ask is, if I'm given a Calabi-Yau threefold with a Ricci-Fled metric, and I fix some homology class, you can ask how many special Lagrangian cycles are there. Well, in general, it's actually, I'm oversimplifying, and that's part of why I call this loose motivation, because in general they would occur in families. But let's suppose we just stick for a minute to the simplest case where they have the topology of S3. In that case, these things are isolated, and you can really just ask how many of them are there in a given homology class. So let's define in quotes omega of gamma to be the number of special Lagrangian, which I'll abbreviate as SLAG, in the class gamma. So this is the sort of prototype of a Donaldson-Thomas invariant, a mirror to the Donaldson-Thomas invariants that Jim had. Okay, so we're calling these invariants, but how invariant are they really? So one of the first questions you can ask about this thing is, suppose that I now deform the Ricci flat metric on my Calabi-Yau. How does this number behave as a function on the moduli space? Now where's the eraser? So how does this thing behave? How does this thing behave as a function over the moduli space of Calabi-Yau? There are, if you like, sort of naive arguments that say the thing is invariant, but it turns out that the actual behavior is a little more subtle. So what can happen is the following thing. So let me draw a picture of the moduli space. The moduli space of metrics on this Calabi-Yau threefold. So I call it B. What can happen is that at one point in the moduli space, you have some. So at this point, you have some special Lagrangian. There's my picture of S3. And as you deform the Ricci flat metric, the special Lagrangian actually also it deforms continuously. But the way that it deforms is to sort of develop a little neck. So it starts to look, as I go maybe to here, the thing starts to look a bit like this. And then when I reach some critical locus, which is a wall of real codimension 1 in the moduli space of complex structures, this special Lagrangian actually splits. So it sort of decays into two special Lagrangians that are intersecting each other. So this is what's happening on the wall. And then beyond the wall, there's no special Lagrangian in this homology class. So if you like here, on this side of the wall, we have omega of gamma equals 1. And on this side of the wall, we have omega of gamma equals 0. So that's sort of the simplest prototype of what this wall crossing phenomenon is. It's just the problem that there are walls in the moduli space, and at those walls, your invariants jump. So the question then, if you want to formulate a good theory of Donaldson-Thomas invariants, one of the questions you certainly have to encounter is exactly how do they jump? And so one way of phrasing the question is, say the wall crossing problem, let's call this point, say, u plus, and this point u minus. So I'll always use u for points in my moduli space where the wall crossing is happening. The wall crossing problem is to determine the set of omega of gamma, omega of gamma and u plus from omega of gamma and u minus. So now I explicitly write the dependence on the point u, since it depends a little bit on it. And this problem now has been, as far as I understand, has been completely solved in the sense that there's a precise formula that tells you, there's a formula that tells you what the behavior should be. So if you had any good theory of Donaldson-Thomas invariants, any fully successfully constructed theory, the wall crossing has to be given by this specific formula. So the right answer is known, let's say. I'll call it the Kontsevich-Seubelmann wall crossing formula, KSWCF, because at least that's where we learned about the formula, was from the paper of Kontsevich and Seubelmann. So I'm not going to write that formula now, but hopefully I will write it at the end of the talk in its sort of, what I think is sort of its natural context. For now, I just want to say that the answer is known. But I want to say one other thing now, which is that although it's hard to figure out exactly what the jumping behavior will be, it is not hard to figure out where the walls will be. So the wall crossing formula is quite complicated, but if you just want to know where is the wall going to be, that's easy. It essentially just follows from the triangle inequality. So what's happening here is that I have a guy in homology class gamma, which is decaying into the union of these two guys in homology classes gamma 1 and gamma 2. And just from the triangle inequality, you see that the only way that this can happen... let's describe it carefully. So let me write W gamma to be the set of U in the moduli space where there exist gamma 1 and gamma 2 with gamma 1 plus gamma 2 equals gamma. Gamma 1 and gamma 2 are linearly independent. And Z gamma 1... Now, also considered as a function of U. So I had these periods before that I called Z gamma. Those are now functions on the moduli space. And the condition is that Z gamma 1 over Z gamma 2 should be a positive real number. So we have these two holomorphic functions, and this is the locus where these two guys line up, up to an overall scale. So you can see that this is a sort of one real equation, and so it defines some locus of codimension, real codimension 1. So that's where the walls are. Okay, so that's the first motivation. That's to give you some idea of what this wall crossing phenomenon is. Let me do a second sort of related motivation. So now I move away from the context of Calabi-Yau threefolds, but I want to describe another situation which has all the same formal properties. Is that okay? So I want to describe another situation that has all the same formal properties. So loose motivation number 2. So instead of talking about a Calabi-Yau threefold, now I want to talk about a Calabi-Yau twofold. Let me call it Q, and Q may be non-compact. And in most of the examples that one can really understand fully, Q would be non-compact. So let's take it to be elliptically fibered by complex tori, compact complex tori. The generic fiber is a torus, and of course it may have some bad fibers, over a base. And I'll call the base B. So now the base of this elliptic fibration is playing the role that was there played by the moduli space of metrics on this Calabi-Yau. So now the analog of the homology, the third homology of the Calabi-Yau, is going to be the relative second homology. Of my Calabi-Yau twofold relative to the elliptic fiber. Right, so the compact complex tori, I call the fibers sigma u, so sigma u is the fiber over u. And then I have, really not just a single lattice, but I have sort of a local system of lattices varying over the base. So I call this the fiber over u, I call it gamma u. And then here again we have a kind of counting problem. So now let's define omega of gamma and u to be, again, this is the definition you would like to have, to be the number of special Lagrangians. Now, open special Lagrangians, which are allowed to have boundary on the elliptic fiber, and again, in the class gamma. So the picture is, here's my elliptic fibration, and I have... have the fiber over a point u, and then I have some, the simplest picture to imagine is I have some disk, some special Lagrangian disk, which is ending on, some special Lagrangian disk inside of Q, which is ending on, the fiber sigma u. Now, of course, this picture makes it look a little bit funny. I mean, how could it be that how is this thing closing off? And the answer is that it closes off at some singularity of the elliptic vibration. So the typical picture is like this. You have some singular point, here where one of the cycles of the torus is pinching. So let me restrict to the simplest case where the singular fibers are just nodes. Sigma U is developing a node, one of the two circles is closing off. And so we can have a disk. We can have a disk which is sort of fibered over this interval in the base, and the generic fiber. Let me slightly redraw this picture. So the generic fiber looks like a circle. So we have this tube here. Here's the boundary circle, which lies on the fiber sigma u. And then on the other side, it's closing off smoothly. I have a disk like this. So this is actually an important part of the story, that whenever our elliptic fiber, sigma u, is close enough to one of these band fibers, we'll find exactly one special Lagrangian disk, which is just looks like this picture. But in general, we may find more. Where did it go? In general, we may find more. So a sort of slightly larger scale picture would look like this. So let's look at a slightly bigger picture of the base of this elliptic vibration, where there are actually several points corresponding to singular fibers. Then, if I sit close to this singular fiber, I have a disk which projects down to this picture. If I sit here, I have a disk which projects down to this picture. But then, as I get further away, there's a third kind of disk that can occur. There's a disk which is sort of the union of two of these things, which looks sort of like this. So this is one disk. This looks like one disk for a while, and then sort of splits into two disks. And this kind of thing exists when my elliptic fiber is out at some distance. Now, as I move the elliptic fiber closer and closer to the to where the singular points are, this disk for a while is just getting shorter and shorter. But when I reach this critical location, this disk is decaying into two special Lagrangian disks. And when I go any closer, this disk doesn't exist anymore. So there's again a kind of wall crossing phenomenon that occurs in this moduli space. So those are two sort of motivations. And here, so as in the other case, this wall crossing is supposed to be exactly described by this wall crossing formula of Kintsevich and Seubelman. So those were some loose motivations, and now let me sort of abstract from this situation the structure that I'm actually going to use. So abstract from these two examples. So the structure I want to use in what follows is first a complex manifold B, that'll be the base, complex dimension, say R. And inside of here, I'm going to have a locus that I'll call the smooth locus, which is just the complement of the, think of it as being the complement of the bad fibers. So this is an open dense subset. Then I'm going to have a local system of lattices. Gamma over the smooth locus, which has to be, it's actually realized, okay, this is a sort of fine print detail. It's probably okay just to think I have a local system of lattices But to say it a little more precisely, the way it comes is it comes as a, in general, as a, as an extension like this, where gamma f is a trivial local system. So this is really just some fixed lattice. And gamma g has rank 2R. I remind you, R was the dimension of my, R was the complex dimension of the base. And gamma g has a symplectic pairing. So it has this anti-symmetric bilinear form, gamma g times gamma g to z. And then, of course, that because of this map, that also pulls back to give you a pairing on gamma, but this pairing may be degenerate. So in this example here, I guess this was the, this is the exact sequence, whatever it is, the exact sequence of relative homology. Okay, good. So I have to have that. I'm not done with the data yet. So the other thing that I had in my examples was I had this z, which gave the periods. So this is a map from gamma to c, which is a fiber-wise homomorphism. So z, in my example, z was just given by integrating a holomorphic volume form over a cycle. So it was clearly linear in the, it's clearly a linear map on homology, a linear map on gamma, and then it varies holomorphically with u. So if I fix my lattice vector and move around in the base, I get a holomorphic function. And this has to obey a couple of side conditions, namely the pairing of dz with dz has to be zero. And moreover, the pairing of dz with dz bar, this would give you a two form on the base, and it has to be positive. Okay, let me not dwell on these conditions too much. So far, these are all kind of, you know, classical geometric data that exist in a lot of situations. And then the last thing that I want to introduce, which is, of course, the most interesting part, is this function, which is supposed to be giving the Donaldson-Thomas invariance, so just an integer-valued function on this local system of lattices, which obeys... The condition on it is that it obeys this wall-crossing formula, which I still haven't written for you, but will write for you, you know, when the moment comes. So these are going to be my data. And from these data, I'm going to construct a Hyper-Keller metric. So that's now the connection to part two of the talk. So far, I just told you what, in my understanding, Donaldson-Thomas invariants are. First, there's something sort of easy that you can do here, which is that the data, so I have data A, B, C, D over there. So A, B, and C, without using these Donaldson-Thomas invariants, are already enough to construct something that's a little bit geometrically interesting. They're enough to build a complex integrable system. What's a complex integrable system? For me, a complex integrable system, what I mean by it is just a complex manifold with holomorphic symplectic form. And in the future, sometimes I'll summarize this by just calling it a holomorphic symplectic manifold. So by this I mean By this I mean both the complex structure and the holomorphic symplectic form, which is fibered by complex Lagrangian tori. So Lagrangian with respect to this holomorphic symplectic form, meaning the holomorphic symplectic form restricts to zero in these tori. And the construction of, so the construction of this, this complex integrable system from this data is relatively easy. Unfortunately, I have to erase some of the data in order to show it to you, but I guess that's okay. In fact, it's kind of, it's almost trivial what you do. What you do is, so first, let me tell you what's the underlying C infinity manifold. So the C infinity manifold, I'll just define, let me define M prime. Again, the prime is just because I'm working away from the singular fibers. What it is it's just the lattice of characters. Sorry, not the lattice, the torus of characters of my lattice gamma, or more precisely, gamma came as an extension, and I just take the gamma g part. So this is a, if I look at one fiber of my local system, so I fix some u, then this is a torus of dimension 2r, and now I have that torus of dimension 2r just fibered over b prime. So the picture is like this. Let's think of the case where b is one dimensional. It really works in any dimension, but you don't lose too much by thinking about one dimension. So then, literally, I just have a piece of the complex plane here. And then, fibered over any point, I have a torus, which is this torus. So it's canonically built out of the lattice gamma. And moreover, because I constructed it this way, it, of course, has canonical functions, or locally defined functions. So if gamma is a local section of gamma, then by just evaluating the characters on gamma, you get a corresponding function, theta gamma, from this M prime into the circle. Now let's define the circle explicitly to be R mod 2 pi z. So we have this sort of more or less trivially defined torus vibration that's just canonically attached to the local system of lattices. And then it's equipped with, so that's the thing as a C infinity manifold, but how do I make it into a holomorphic symplectic manifold? Well, for that, all I have to do actually is tell you the holomorphic symplectic form. That already determines the complex structure, in fact, just by the condition that this form is of type 2, 0. So the holomorphic symplectic form let me define it by this funny omega with a little line over it. And I'll call it omega zero for reasons that will become clear in a second. It's also given just by a simple sort of formal thing. Well, maybe I should unpack what this formula means. So remember, we had these functions, z gamma, which started out their life as functions on the base, but now just by lifting them up to m prime, I can make them functions on m prime. So these are functions from m prime to c. And we also had the functions theta gamma from m prime to the circle. And all we do here is we take the sort of vector of one form's dz and the vector of one form's d theta and pair them using this symplectic pairing. So this is the holomorphic symplectic form. So what we've got so far is a complex integrable system that's attached to my data. Now there's a funny thing, and a lot of complex integrable systems that are sort of arise in nature. Are examples of this construction. But the funny thing is that complex integrable systems that arise in nature often have a little bit more structure that you might not expect. So they're actually not just complex integrable systems. they're not just holomorphic symplectic manifolds, but they actually carry hyperkähler metrics. And so the question that one might ask is, you know, is that structure of hyperkähler metrics somehow also constructible from these data, or do you need something a little bit more? And I want to say that the crucial extra thing that you need in order to build the hyperkähler metrics on these spaces is you need these functions, these integer-valued functions obeying the Kincevich-Soebelman wall crossing formula. So one way of saying it is that from these integers, you can build the complex integrable system. You can build the hyperkähler metric. The reverse way of saying it is that inside every complex integrable system that has a hyperkähler metric, which is somehow most of them, secretly these invariants are kind of imprinted. You can read them out from the structure of the hyperkähler metric. And once you know them, you've actually determined the hyperkähler metric. Okay, so how does it go? How do we actually construct the metric? I want to build a hyperkähler metric on M prime. Well, in fact, I want to do more than just build a hyperkähler metric on M prime. In fact, that wouldn't be very hard. There's a sort of trivial formula, almost tautological formula, like the things I was doing so far, which would give you a hyperkähler metric on M prime. My goal is really to construct one which will have an extension over the singular fibers. So admitting a complete extension over the singular fibers. So this M prime just lived over B prime, but I want to be able to sort of fill in by adding some degenerate fibers. And it's for this that you really need to do something non-trivial. And what we're going to do is we're going to use the sort of twister philosophy on what a hyperkähler metric is. So this is due to the basic technology that we use is due to Hitchin, Carlid, Lindstrom, and Rochek, and also has been very well described separately by Hitchin. And the idea is that first of all, what is a hyperkähler metric? So a hyperkähler metric is usually defined to be a metric, a single metric, which is kähler for three complex structures simultaneously. And those three complex structures have to obey the quaternion relations. But in fact, it's an immediate consequence of that definition that not only is the thing kähler with respect to three complex structures, it's kähler with respect to a whole CP1 worth of complex structures. A hyperkähler manifold has, canonically, a CP1 worth of kähler structures. And in fact, it has more than that. In each of those, in each fixed complex structure, you have three symplectic forms. One of the symplectic forms gives you the kähler structure, and the other two symplectic forms give you a holomorphic symplectic form. So in fact, one way of describing the thing is to say that it has a CP1 worth of holomorphic symplectic structures. So let me call this CP1. I'll parameterize it by the inhomogeneous coordinate zeta. And then these holomorphic symplectic structures, let me call them omega zeta. So before I had omega 0, and now I want to extend that to a whole CP1 worth of holomorphic symplectic structures. And if you specify, so it's part of this the twister technology that specifying omega zeta for all zeta is equivalent to specifying the hyperkähler metric. Um, So rather than trying to construct hyperkeller metric sort of by hand, we're going to work entirely in the world of holomorphic symplectic geometry. And so what we'll do is we'll construct the these holomorphic symplectic structures, in fact, by giving sort of local Darboux coordinates. So so we build these omega zeta by giving holomorphic Darboux coordinates. So these are going to be some functions. I'll call them y gamma. Again, they're locally defined because gamma is only a local section, but never mind. Y gamma from m prime times c star to c star. So it's a function. It's going to be a function on m prime that also depends on this coordinate zeta. In fact, depends holomorphically on zeta. And they're again sort of characters, so they obey y gamma prime is y gamma plus gamma prime. And omega of zeta will be given by just d log y, comma d log y. So this is what I mean by saying they're Darboux coordinates. The logs of y are like the p and q. Okay. So how do we build these y gammas? Well, as it turns out, here's what you have to do. So y gamma should obey the integral equation here it is. So y gamma, I'll write explicitly the dependence on zeta because the zeta dependence is all that is going to enter this equation. Well, there's first a sort of simple explicit part. Which just says essentially that this y gamma is a kind of complexification of the coordinate e to the I theta gamma, the sort of Fourier modes along the torus. So we're taking those Fourier modes on the torus and we're complexifying them by throwing in some pieces that depend on these functions z gamma, which were functions on the base. So this is like, if you want a rough picture of what's going on, this is like these are coordinates on R2 times T2, and you're identifying R2 times T2 with C star times C star. So this is the simple part. And if you just use this formula, you would get the sort of naive, uncorrected hyperkeller metric that I told you exists, which has no good extension over the singular fibers. So now, the way that you improve this guy is to throw in a second term, which looks like this. So it's a sum now over all the lattice vectors, all lattice vectors gamma prime, weighed by their inner product, their symplectic inner product with gamma, and also weighed by these Donaldson-Thomas invariants. So this is the moment where the Donaldson-Thomas invariant enters the construction. And now there's an integral, integral over L gamma prime. So this is an integral over a new coordinate zeta prime. Which has just this simple integral kernel, and then it has a piece which involves the functions y gamma again. Okay. So I have to tell you what the contour of integration is. So this contour of integration is just a ray in the zeta plane. It's all zeta prime for which z gamma prime over zeta prime is real and negative. Okay. So this equation probably isn't immediately digestible, so I'll tell you the sort of important consequences of it as we go. But for now, I just want to say it's some correction of a simple explicit metric, and the correction involves, in an interesting way, these Donaldson-Thomas invariants. And this is really an equation that has to be solved because the functions y gamma appear on both sides of the equation. I guess one other thing I should say is that here a parameter appeared which hasn't appeared before in the story. So I had this r. So r is some positive real number. And so I'm really constructing not just one hyperkeller metric, but a family of hyperkeller metrics that depend on that parameter. Okay. So now I can state the first theorem. So that's what I'm about to state. So I'm about to state that it's automatically hyperkeller. The Y gammas that you construct in this way, what they obviously define for you a family of holomorphic symplectic structures. I'm just telling you them by this formula. Now, what's non-trivial about the story is that this is only a construction for zeta in C star. It doesn't cover zeta equals zero and zeta equals infinity. So it's not obvious that I've really constructed a whole family of complex symplectic structures, right? I have to construct the whole twister family. But fortunately, this integral equation actually guarantees that these functions have very specific asymptotics as zeta goes to zero at infinity. In fact, in those limits, you can basically forget this correction, and you basically have the asymptotics that are just given by this naive formula. That naive formula, by explicit calculation, does define a hyperkeller metric. And so that means it has sufficiently good properties at zero at infinity. Okay, well, that's a rough way of stating the argument for the theorem, so let me just tell you the theorem. So the first theorem so let's pick pick some locus U and M prime, and for a minute let's be conservative and let's say that it doesn't meet any walls. So remember, in the base of this elliptic fiber, in the base of this torus vibration, we have a bunch of walls. And let's look at a locus that doesn't meet the inverse image of any of those walls. So suppose that there exist these functions y gamma from u times c star to c star obeying this integral equation. Let me call them star. We call this integral equation star. Then there exists a hyperkeller metric on U such that the form I was writing of this omega of zeta is the holomorphic symplectic form. And this, as I said, this essentially just follows from the twister technology, plus a little bit of care about the asymptotic behavior as zeta goes to zero at infinity. So this is kind of a local thing. It didn't have anything to do with these Donaldson Thomas invariants. The invariants could have been anything, and this still would have been true. In particular, they could have been zero. So now is the more interesting part. I mean, we're not interested in just constructing little patches of a hyperkeller manifold. We want to glue them together into something that's sort of globally interesting. So the next statement, let me look a little closer at the properties of the functions y gamma obeying this integral equation. So I said you don't have to look too close at this equation, but there's one feature that's important. And the feature that's important is that functions y gamma of zeta, so they're functions on, of course, m times c star, but let me just focus on the dependence on the zeta. They're actually not analytic as functions of zeta, but they're only sectionally analytic as functions of zeta. Sectionally analytic in zeta. So the picture is like this. If I put here the zeta plane, here's the origin. There are some rays in the zeta plane. Draw them like this. these distinguished rays, which were the contours of integration for this integral. And you notice that if zeta lies exactly on one of these contours, then this integral picks up a pole. And so it's a priori not well defined. And indeed, it's really not well defined. So I don't define the function on these rays. You only define it in the complement of these rays. And and there, it's really only sectionally analytic. So so we have these rays L gamma prime, say L gamma double prime, and so on. These functions are only sectionally analytic. But on the other hand, you can say exactly what's the relation between the pieces in different wedges here. So if I write here, so let's say the limit of y gamma as I approach L gamma prime from this side, let's call it y gamma plus. And on the other side, the limit as I approach L gamma prime from the other side, let's call it y gamma minus. Then these two things are related in quite a simple way. Namely, y gamma plus, well, it's almost equal to y gamma minus, but there's a multiplicative factor that enters. And the multiplicative factor is determined by this gamma prime. And it's just 1 minus y gamma prime to the power, the symplectic product of gamma with gamma prime, times this invariant omega of gamma prime. So if the invariant is 0, then there's no jump. Then the thing is really continuous. But whenever this invariant is non-zero, it creates a sort of discontinuity in these canonical functions. Now, luckily, you might say, well, that destroys the whole story, right? Because I was constructing the holomorphic symplectic form. I was constructing the holomorphic symplectic form from these y's. And surely the holomorphic symplectic form has to be holomorphic. Well, luckily it is. So these transformations, this transformation is actually a symplectomorphism acting on the y's. So even though the y's are discontinuous, this holomorphic symplectic form is not. It's actually continuous. Okay, fine. But now comes the important point. So what I told you so far is just what happens. Is just the behavior of these functions y gamma at a single point of m prime. I'm just describing their behavior as a function of zeta. But now suppose that I move around in m prime, and particularly suppose I move around in the base, and I come close to one of these walls of marginal stability. Well, what happens at the wall? Well, what happens to this picture, of course, is that these rays where the functions are discontinuous, the positions of these rays were determined by the phases of the z gammas. So as I move around in the base B, these rays are moving around. So as we vary U and B, the rays L gamma prime move. And in particular, there will come a moment when the rays actually hit each other. Now that moment corresponds exactly to, so let's draw a little picture. M prime was my torus vibration over B prime. So the prime just means I delete the singular fibers. Well, the walls live in B, but you can always lift them up. So I sometimes speak of them as walls in B, and sometimes speak of them as walls in just their inverse image is a wall in M prime. That's right. So as we move around in M prime, so the projection of our point moves around in B, it's B prime. These rays move, and so we can imagine a sequence of three U's. Let's say this is the configuration of the rays at U plus. Then there's the configuration of the rays at, let's say, U critical, U sub wall, where several of these rays have actually hit each other. Um, And then there's the situation on the other side of the wall. Call it U minus. Where again, now these rays have split up again. But this exactly corresponded to crossing one of the walls in the moduli space. And so the invariance omega of gamma here, so here I have some invariance omega of gamma U plus. Here I have some invariance omega of gamma U minus. And the wall crossing phenomenon is exactly that these invariants may be different from these invariants. And so in particular, I may even have a different set of rays here. I may have more rays if on this side there are more non-zero invariants than over here. It corresponds to having more discontinuities in my function y gamma. So now the question arises, well, are these functions y gamma continuous as a function of u? So they're solutions, they're supposed to be solutions of an integral equation with these discontinuities. So here they have one set of discontinuities. Here they have a quite different set of discontinuities. And so you can ask, are they continuous as a function of u? Well, this is where the Kansevich-Soibelman wall crossing formula comes in. So the Kansevich-Soibelman wall crossing formula. So let me introduce just one tiny bit of notation. Let me call this transformation, this symplectic transformation of the y gammas. Let me write it as y gamma plus equals k gamma prime to the omega of gamma prime acting on y gamma minus. So across each of these rays, I have some corresponding transformation. So I have k gamma prime to the omega of gamma prime. Here I have k gamma double prime to the omega of gamma double prime, and so on. And what Kansevich and Soibelman said, though they said it in a quite different context, what they said was that you should consider for any two phases, say theta and theta prime, define S of theta and theta prime to be just the product over all gamma such that the argument of Z gamma lies between theta and theta prime of the symplectic morphism K gamma prime to the omega of gamma prime. They said, consider this symplectic morphism, and their wall crossing formula was exactly that S of theta and theta prime is constant as a function of u. So going back to this picture over here. Oh, sorry, gamma prime. Thank you. So going back to this picture, what their formula says is exactly, suppose I say that this is my angle theta, and this is my angle theta prime, then Kansevich and Soibelman told us to consider exactly the composition of all these symplectic morphisms, the product of k gamma to the omega of gamma, as theta goes from theta, as the inclination goes from theta to theta prime. So here the total symplectic morphism that these functions y gamma encounter is exactly S of theta and theta prime. And here on the other side, although I have a quite different looking picture, nevertheless, if the invariants obey the Kansevich-Soibelman wall crossing formula, this total symplectic morphism is again S of theta and theta prime. So this is exactly the condition that allows our construction to be continuous. So under the assumption, so now I can state the second theorem. So the second theorem, so if the omega of gamma obey the wall crossing formula, Now I've told you what the wall crossing formula is. It's sort of tailor-made for our situation. It's exactly the statement that this symplectomorphism doesn't change as you vary u. Then we can remove the condition that u doesn't overlap any walls. In the previous theorem. And so what this says is that the construction of this Hyperkeller metric is really a global construction. It works over the whole base. It doesn't have any discontinuities. And so there are just a few more comments to make. Yeah, so far, that's right. So far, everything that I said is consistent with the omegas being zero. So that's the first comment. So, I have just a couple of minutes. But of course, that's right. If I have no symplectomorphism, that's of course perfectly continuous. So the first comment. So far, we constructed a Hyperkeller metric. Okay. So far, we constructed a Hyperkeller metric on M prime. Which was the complement of the singular fibers. So when does it extend to a complete metric, to a complete Hyperkeller metric on some M to B? And the answer is that it does provided that the omega of gammas are suitably chosen. And I have to say a little about what suitably chosen means. Well, let me just say what it means in the very simplest case. So for example, let me go back to the example. The second example that I had as the motivation. This was the example where I had a family of elliptic curves that develops a node, right? And in that situation, we said that when my fiber sigma u is close to the place where the family develops a node, that there's a single special Lagrangian disk, right? So if this is charge gamma, this corresponds to the situation where omega of gamma equals 1. Now, this non-zero invariant with omega of gamma equals 1 turns out to be exactly what's needed to fix up the singularity, at this fiber. And in general, that's the situation you expect, that near any particular singularity, one particular, or in general, maybe finitely many particular invariants that are non-zero, and those non-zero invariants do exactly the job of fixing up the singular behavior. So this is something that's what can I say about it? So this is fully proven in the sort of simplest case of the of a singularity that looks like this, where you just need a single invariant to fix it up. And more generally, if you pick some very non-generic situation, then you still expect to have an extension, but the extension may be still a little bit singular. It may have some singularities in codimension 4. Okay. So the only other comment I want to make, is that there are some examples where this whole construction can be carried out very explicitly. So where this can all be done explicitly. By which I mean the Y gamma can be constructed. The Y gamma can be constructed sort of directly without solving this integral equation. And in particular, the most fundamental example is this so-called Oguri-Wafa metric, which really corresponds to this situation where you just have a single singular fiber. And it's a hyperkähler metric on a torus vibration over the disk. And the second example, which is actually a much more interesting example, is moduli spaces of ramified Higgs bundles, ramified SU2 Higgs bundles. In this case, there's a totally independent construction of these functions y gamma with the appropriate jumps and so on, which turns out to be connected to the theory of cluster varieties. So just to briefly summarize, the main thing I told you is that in any situation where you have a family of Donaldson-Thomas invariants that have the right wall crossing behavior, that there's a sort of canonical way of constructing a hyperkähler metric out of them, and the role of the Donaldson-Thomas invariants is exactly to sort of smooth out some singularities that you would naively have encountered. Okay, that's it. Thanks. Yeah. Well, in a certain sense, you could say that that's kind of what we did here. So. I mean, here we really had an a priori construction of these functions y gamma. I mean, this moduli space sort of comes with natural functions y gamma. No, they weren't known. Well, they're closely related to things that had been known before, but they hadn't exactly been known before. So in that case, there's some canonical functions, and you can just ask, how do they jump? Right, and from those jumps, then you discover these omegas. And in that case, they turn out to have a quite simple geometric interpretation. So they're, again, counting things. In this case, they're counting some special curves on a surface rather than special Lagrangians. Okay, so in principle, you might think that you can do this even when the base is compact. But in cases where the base is compact, it's not so easy to construct all the data that I had listed. So, for example, you could try to do this for a K3 surface. You could try to construct the Ricci-Flatt metric on a K3 surface. Now, there are several serious obstacles to doing that. The first obstacle is to construct the integers omega of gamma obeying the wall crossing formula. So from my sort of example two, what you sort of expect is that those are counting some special Lagrangian disks ending on elliptic fibers of K3, but I have no idea, beyond some very vague ideas, how to really write down those numbers in any explicit way. And in particular, okay, you might think it's not so bad not to have an explicit formula. Still, you could say something in terms of those numbers. But there's a second problem, which is I wrote down this integral equation, and I actually didn't tell you much about how to solve that integral equation. Now, in cases where the omega of gammas don't grow very quickly as functions of gamma, then there's an argument, just a very simple argument, just basically like, you know, contraction, the integral, you can show that the integral operator is a contraction, and so, you know, it has to have some fixed point. But that really depends on having some estimate of how fast these omega of gammas grow. Now, so for K3, if you wanted to do K3, you would have to at least know that the number of disks, that the number of these special Lagrangian cycles with boundary is not growing too fast as a function of gamma. And that, at the moment, we don't know how to do. Well, the formal machinery, goes through. But, first of all, you can't say anything explicit. Second of all, there's one step in applying the machinery which isn't so clear, which is the step of solving this integral equation. I wrote down an integral equation, but I wrote it down in terms of sums over over all charges gamma prime. So there's a question of whether that sum actually converges or not. So of course we expect that it does, but I wouldn't claim to be able to prove anything in that direction.